Welcome to Positively Progressive.
This is Alan Minsky, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America. On this installment of Positively Progressive, Donna Smith presents the new leader of Healthcare Now, one of PDA's longtime partners on the road to improve expanded single-payer Medicare for all. Exactly the healthcare system we need in this country. Veteran organizer Jillian Mason talks with Donna about taking the helm from Benjamin Day as Benjamin moves on to organize around the climate crisis. Jillian and Donna will talk about the realities of the U.S. healthcare system and how we get from here to Medicare for all. And then Positively Progressive highlights another amazing young leader from perhaps the most progressive state in the entire United States. We'll hear from Vermont State Senator Keisha Ram Hinsdale, who gives inspiration to all of us as she ascends to one elected leadership position after another, while also raising her young, growing family. Keisha fights for women, economic equity, and the progressive policies that allow all of us to thrive. Enjoy these great conversations. Up now, the great Donna Smith.
Hey folks, this is Donna Smith with Positively Progressive for Progressive Democrats of America. We have a really exciting segment this time around with a new leader in an organization that's been super close to PDA for all of our years of existence. We both were formed in the same year, in 2004. So we all are experiencing a 20th anniversary. Some of us are very proud of that. The other side of us says, we got to get this done with single-payer Medicare for all. But I'm here to talk with this amazing activist and organizer who I've known for a very long time and am so excited that she is becoming the new executive director of Healthcare Now. And her name is Jillian Mason. She is based in the great state of Texas, believe it or not.
Certainly.
And Jillian, welcome to Positively Progressive. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Donna. I'm very excited to be here. I'm excited to be, you know, helping to sort of carry forward the legacy that you and other folks have built at Healthcare Now. And excited to, you know, really engage the great state of Texas in this project of healthcare justice. So
if you can do that, you will have cracked a nut we've all been working on for a long, long time.
Not making any promises, but yeah.
So who are you, Jillian? I know a little about you, but the people listening here may not. Tell us about you and how you came to this issue and to this organizing.
I mean, ask backwards is the short answer. I was actually going to be an English professor, and I was like super excited about it. It's a boring dream, but it was mine. And I was very excited about it. I went into grad school where I had a really terrible health insurance plan. And we had to fight to get even that terrible health insurance plan. But unfortunately, it wasn't enough. And when I got sick with a couple of different chronic illnesses in the middle of my grad career, I went broke. I was in and out of the hospital all the time. I was trigger warning, but I was ready to end it all. I was ready to be done with my life. And that's when I met some folks in the healthcare justice movement. And, whereas I had been ashamed before, like I thought this was, and we've talked about this before, you know, like when you have a problem with the healthcare system, you can really internalize it, right? And say, no, I must not be doing something right. And so when I met these healthcare justice advocates, I realized that I wasn't alone and that I didn't have to be ashamed. And that's when I started telling my story, talking about my issues with the healthcare system. It's where I met Ben Day, who is our outgoing executive director of Healthcare Now.
Sorry to say that, right?
Yeah. I will, yeah. I mean, I met Ben Day in 2011, I think, when we were doing civil disobedience together at the Cigna healthcare office in Newton, Massachusetts. And we were getting arrested together to try to stop Cigna from investing their profits in lobbying against Medicare for all. So So it's been, I worked once I got a taste of organizing, though, I was hooked. Organizing is a gateway drug. And pretty soon you're knee deep in the movement. So I ended up working in the labor movement for 12 years, for a coalition called Jobs with Justice, which is amazing. And
A
I know
group, yeah, they're
a
amazing.
lot with PVA on the national level. And I got just a lot of experience in different kinds of campaigns. And I was based in Boston at the time.
Yeah, how'd you end up in Texas?
Well,
How the heck did you go from Boston to Texas, woman?
Boston is pretty stressful. And so,
Really?
yeah, I mean, it's very expensive and cold. So, and fast-paced. So I told my partner we need to move somewhere that is slower, cheaper, and warmer. And here we ended up in Corpus Christi. So I live in Corpus Christi, Texas. It's right on the Gulf of Mexico. It's a very, very interesting place to be. I live in a majority Mexican city. And so I get to see a lot of the inequality that comes with that. And I'm about 100 miles north of the border, so we get our share of those debates as well. So
Absolutely. Wow. And what do you, I mean, do you see, you must see the healthcare stresses playing out almost daily in communities. I mean, how in the world these poor folks who, I don't care what people think about the immigration policy of this country, if we think as human beings, after having walked some of them hundreds, thousands of miles, must come across the border with healthcare concerns that are very serious.
Oh my God.
I mean, what the heck does anybody do? What do they do?
I mean, it's really, really nuts. And I mean, I think that when people imagine Texas, they imagine a million Ted Cruzes, right? They imagine that everyone in Texas is like Ted Cruz or Greg Abbott or
Oh,
Warner or
yes.
whatever. But the truth is that there's a very small number of Ted Cruzes and Greg Abbotts and these old school, hyper conservative, far right wing, white man leaders, and they're holding the rest of us hostage, and so it's very different on the ground here, I think, than people would imagine. But yeah, I think everyone here has the feeling that we're under attack constantly from our state government.
Yeah, I just saw a quote this morning in a meme on Facebook of from someone very famous from Texas, a woman, Ann Richardson, who did, oh my gosh. I mean, the state misses her as a voice, and thank God they're going to be great people like you to kind of take up that slack and speak about Texas and about the people from Texas, that we can't pigeonhole them any more than we can pigeonhole all the people in Florida. And the way their state is reacting right at the moment. And, and
Well,
for.
I don't know. We like to, I mean, in Texas, we always say, at least we're not Florida.
I lived in Florida for a while, and I promise it was the place for me. I first felt in the shame that you talked about with healthcare. I lied to get my husband into the hospital. I just flat out lied. And I knew I was lying. But I knew it was either that or he would die. He needed open heart surgery, and I needed to say that my insurance would pay, and it wasn't a pre-existing condition at the time. Those conditions were very strong, and I just flat out said, "Oh no, everything's fine. Everything's great. Everything's in order." And so I had to break my own ethical code of operations to do that for him. Would do it again today in an instant,
Oh,
would.
yeah, absolutely. I'd lie on that one every time.
Yeah, but at the same time, the things that we are all forced to do to get that kind of care, ridiculous. And that it still continues today, really ridiculous, really. So you ended up with healthcare now, which we're all extremely grateful for. Those of you who don't know a lot about healthcare now, Jillian, fill us in. Tell us about healthcare now. What is its mission? What have they been doing, and what do they hope to do?
Yeah, I mean, we're one of the largest single payer organizations advocating for what you could call single payer. You might call Medicare for all. You might call universal health care. Whatever it is, it's a healthcare system where everybody's in and nobody's out. So we're fighting for that really on many different levels. We have activists around the country who are fighting for, everything from municipal resolutions around Medicare for All to state legislation on Medicare for All to the federal bill, of course, which we all work on all the time. And then into other areas like defending the public systems that we currently have, like Medicare, Medicaid, and our VA, our Indian Health Services, et cetera. So really, we get involved at all different levels of healthcare justice. And that's one of the things that I think is so important about healthcare now is that we are see ourselves not just as a wonky organization trying to pass one bill, right? We're trying to build a movement that's legitimately for justice and equity. And we provide a lot of different resources for that fight to people, like I said, all over the country who are fighting on the ground. We help them with materials, communications. We do trainings for activists. If you, have never been involved before, or just mildly interested in this issue, come to our trainings and you can learn how to take action in your community. And then we also do a biweekly podcast.
Right. Where do people find that? Where do they find the podcast?
It is the Medicare for All podcast. You can find it on your favorite podcast platform, Spotify.
Definitely progressive, same thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then, of course, we do all the other stuff, lobbying and putting out reports and, just trying to highlight the voices of ordinary people who are impacted by the healthcare system. It's a lot, but I think unless you take that kind of approach, that kind of diversity of tactics approach, I don't think we're gonna win. So
where do you think the movement is right now? When you look at it, where do you think our strengths are? Where do you think we need reinforcement and more work? Where do you think the movement stands right now for healthcare justice?
I would say this. I would say we are too small to have the impact that we need to have, right? We have a big task ahead of us and we need to be bigger in order to make that happen. And so I think that, the future of the movement, at least for the next few years, is really about base building. It's about getting our people together and making sure that we're reaching out to the people who are most impacted by this crisis. And it is a crisis. It's an ongoing, everyday crisis. I think that's really, that's sort of the negative, but also the positive if we have this opportunity to grow. And then I think the most exciting thing about our movement right now is that I think that people are really starting to think about intersectionality and think about healthcare as a part of a larger social justice movement, a part of a larger health justice movement, working alongside folks who are fighting for abortion access and for access to gender affirming care for trans folks, right? Healthcare for houseless people, healthcare for undocumented immigrants, right? We're connected to all of those folks. And I think that we need to see ourselves as part of that movement. And then I think in general, also, we're part of a larger social justice movement that's about racial equity and equity, gender equity, and, protecting, trans folks and queer folks from being victimized by our current system. So I think is the most exciting thing. I see a lot of young people in particular who are really interested in the idea of Medicare for All, because Medicare for All would actually deliver some of these other things that they care about.
Wow. I mean, what a great, and to be based in Texas for all of that. Some of the biggest national, the biggest profile national cases around trans rights, around women's body autonomy rights. The recent case in Texas with the young pregnant mom who needed abortion. Yeah, I mean, a great place to be based to really build that support. I remember early in my days with Healthcare Now, we launched this ambitious bus tour that we took on this old, oh God, a 1980 school bus with six seats left in it, and a bus driver who was a Vietnam vet who was still pissed off about it. So we had this, we went to 12 states, 17 congressional districts, and we traveled around and just spoke with people about what was going on in their lives. And I think the pandemic kind of, at least in my view, truncated that face-to-face contact with human beings, with how we relate to each other about these issues. And, you know, whether or not we can make that, we can revitalize that electronically with Zoom only, or whether or not we're going to have to get out there in the trenches again, my feeling is we're going to have to do both. And, you know, I think that's going to be difficult. There's no doubt about it. That's going to be really hard. And You having taken the helm of one of the organizations that I deeply love and respect, I've been on the board a long time. I've been in the steering committee for a long time and hope to be until we win this fight. I mean, what do you see that we will have to do post-pandemic to really build? I agree with you. We've got to build capacity. Our numbers still don't stand up to the numbers of dollars the insurance companies, that, you know, the United Healthcare's, and oh my God, they're taking over Medicare through Medicare Advantage. What do you think we're going to have to do?
I mean, a lot, and in a short amount of time.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think you're right about, I think you're right that it's going to have to be twofold, right? We definitely are going to have to get out in person more. But I think also, you know, a lot of people, like, there are some benefits from going digital, right? And one of them is accessibility, right? Like, think about how many of our friends who are people with disabilities.
Absolutely.
Have been able to, like, take, you know, participate in things like meetings and events and stuff like that, like, never before, right? Because of Zoom. So I do think that we should, like, I think that we need to focus on the positive aspects of digital organizing, which is that we're able to reach people who are, you know, firmly planted in front of their computer and may not be able to come out in person. But I think that ultimately, whether we're in person or whether we're digital, it's some very old fashioned kind of skills that we need to be developing. You know, it's about learning how to tell our story in a way that's compelling to people. And it's about, I'm sorry, can you hear the noise in the background here?
Not a bit.
Could we pause for just one moment though?
Of course. All right, so we're talking about with Jillian Mason, the new executive director of Healthcare Now, about how in the world we take this moment in movement, whether it's our social justice and for healthcare justice or other movements. I heard a friend recently say something about, she was flabbergasted when she went to Manhattan, that the biggest building in Manhattan is the Zoom building. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. The biggest brick and mortar structure in Manhattan is the Zoom building, which is, you think about that, it's kind of bizarre, but you're right. Without Zoom during the pandemic, many of us would have felt a crushing isolation. And imagine all of our movements and what might have happened, because conference calls, just which we used to exist on almost solely, don't have the same impact as being able to see one another. So how are you anticipating that Healthcare Now might take this moment in the movement where we're blending those two kinds of things, in person and digital? What do you think?
I mean, I think, you know, like I said, diversity of tactics, I think, is where it's at. So I think that we're, you know, going to be continuing to do things like offering our trainings online so that we can reach people all over the country. But we're also building up to try to do some more in-person gatherings where we can actually meet and talk to each other and share some food, right? That always helps.
Oh, yeah. The nurses always really used to say, feed them and they will come.
You know, build community, right? So yeah, but like I said, I think whether it's digital or whether it's in person, I think it's like some very old-fashioned skills. It's learning how to tell our stories in ways that are persuasive, whether you're doing it on TikTok or in a, you know, district meeting with your congressional representative. And it's about legitimately being able to listen to people and listen to their issues with the healthcare system. And honestly, I think you could do some of that digitally, but you have to really put your human hat on. And sometimes the digital world takes away some of our
humanity. It can, but I think you're one of the things you're best at is emanating this humanity from the screen, and not everybody can do that. Not everybody feels, people are getting more comfortable with it, I think. But I think it still can be difficult for some folks. But wow, is it true about disabled folks, people with different abilities? We certainly see that at PDA, that we're seeing lots more participation. We had this kick-ass town hall meeting yesterday with young people who were leading the conversation. And all we had to do was sit back and listen. It was marvelous. Yeah, and I think you're discussing some of that too, as well. That young people get it; they understand that if we don't change this system, the world they're coming into will not be the one into which they want to bring children, and they want to raise families. I mean, how do you afford it? How do you make it work in this country? And you know, I think before we close out for today, and Jillian, you're just a delight. I want to make sure that we have you again. One of the things I'm seeing in the movement that is stressing a little bit, distressing a little bit, but also shows our growth is this kind of push me, pull me between the people who are really working in their states to get some healthcare legislation moving forward on the state level and people who believe that it can only go federally. And from my perspective, it's a walk and chew gum at the same time issue. You know, the reality is, I think you can do both. I think Canada's the great example of that. But what do you think that maybe we can all do to embrace one another during this time and make sure that we don't form that circular firing squad that's so damaging?
Yeah, I hate that. Like, I hate that. Again, time to put your human hat on, right? We are all people and we are all desperately trying towards the same goal. Like, you know, I think we need to remember that. I think we also need to remember that no one of us knows how this is going to work, right? No one of us knows what's the strategy that's going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, right? But I think that, like, you know, I learned a lot from the labor movement, in particular from working with Latin American trade unionists. And one of the lessons that they taught me was about the pulpo. The pulpo is the octopus in Spanish. And this is an organizing model that they picked up from organizing against United Fruit Company. And basically what they said is that if you're trying to catch an octopus and have it for dinner, which I wouldn't necessarily want to do, but a lot of people like octopus. but if you're trying to catch an octopus, if you try to grab one of its legs, the octopus is just going to swim, is going to detach its own leg, and it's going to swim away and go on to live again and victimize someone else. So what they learned when they were fighting these big U.S. corporations was that you have to tie up all the legs of the octopus at once and then bash it over the head in order to get that octopus. And I think that that's kind of what's happening here when we see the movement for state-based single payer, federal single payer. Again, even these municipal resolutions saying that, you know, at a city level, we need to do something about this.
Yeah, I was proud of Denver. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, there were a couple in Denton, Texas, they passed one. And so I think that that's what we're doing. I think we're rounding up the legs of the octopus. And I think that that's something that we need to do. I think we need to be attacking them from all angles. So I appreciate the diversity of strategies in our movement because, like you said, it's a sign of growth, right? That we're big enough to have people with different opinions.
One of my favorite times in the movement was there was an amendment to the Affordable Care Act way back when that was offered that would allow states to do their own implementation of whatever healthcare plans they felt were best. And it got to committee in the House, and I was watching it very early in the morning. I was in California for a conference, and I was watching it, and I remember calling my boss, Michael Leidy, at the time, and saying, we're going to, I used a word that was more colorful, but I said, we are going to win this thing. We're going to win. And the reality was we had Republicans who love states' rights, who were voting for it in enough numbers, and Democrats who love the idea of universal health care voting for it. And I thought, oh my God, we found an issue on which they both will go at it for different reasons, but I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't. Now it got stripped out of, unfortunately, it got stripped out of the Affordable Care Act by Nancy Pelosi as one of the chips she was bargaining with at the time. But we thought, oh my God, it is possible. So when I see even Ro Khanna's work right at the moment to allow a bill to advance that essentially does the same thing, that allows states to develop their own plans, I think right on. Because John Conyers, who was long the sponsor of H.R. 676, that was Healthcare Now's, their battle cry for a long time, always told me, when we win one Republican, we will win this battle. As soon as we win one. We haven't done it yet on the national level. And it just hasn't happened yet. But I believe it will. It will.
I also believe it will.
There will be a Republican somewhere, like in other countries, that have had a relative who's been victimized or themselves been victimized.
I mean, the honest thing is that Medicare for All makes, even by their twisted, predatory capitalist logic, Medicare for All makes sense. I think that the Republicans eventually are going to have to turn towards Medicare for All because, Walmart doesn't want to pay health care for its employees.
Well, we're all essentially paying it as employees get on Medicaid.
This is true.
Walmart, we're subsidizing that in a big, big way, which always says to me, we got a corporation that's gotten enormously wealthy in the world by leaning into our public programs. And, I believe we'll win. I don't know if it'll be in my lifetime. I know that it might. I think it's more possible now. But the other thing I always try and tell people is Quentin Young, who was one of the founders of PNHP, Physicians for a National Health Program, always said to me, anything that moves us closer to the day when we achieve healthcare justice, we should support. Anything that moves us further away from that day, we should oppose. And that simple battle cry for me has been what I lean on. Because I know that there are, even in Colorado just today, passed our house, a bill that would allow our public health policy school to make a new study of how much it would save Colorado if we went to universal health care. Yay, we haven't had a pertinent real-time study. We've been leaning into one that was in 2008, for goodness sakes. It is now 2024. So it's time to do that. It's time to find out. It's time to study again and to prove again, once again. Mm-hmm. If there's not, by that twisted capitalistic logic, oh my God, would it save money?
Woo. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of dough. A lot of dough. So Jillian, thank you so much for being with us today. And we will definitely have you back to talk about more about what Healthcare Now is doing. So thank you, Jillian, so much. We will see you again. And maybe we'll do a bus tour again.
I love it. It's coming in Texas, right?
I'm game. I could do it.
All right. You're going to have to drive the bus, though.
Thank God. Talk to you soon. Thank you. Hi, everybody. This is Donna Smith with PDA's Positively Progressive, and I'm so excited to be joined this evening by a friend of mine from many years ago. We spoke on a panel together that Dr. Paul Song invited us to be on at, I think it was at Netroots Nation. And Keisha Ram Hinsell is now a Vermont state senator after making many successful runs at state office, and she made one run at perhaps a congressional seat, and I'm sure hoping she'll do that again in the future. But Keisha, you and I know each other a little bit, but the audience doesn't know you. Would you please tell everybody out in our world, who are you and what are you all about?
Oh, thanks so much, Donna. Well, I consider you a shero and a mentor, even if we don't always get to catch up. I just watch how much you do and how you keep plugging away. And, you know, I often like to say that young people don't give me hope. They give me courage to keep paving the way so that they have space. And I think you do that well also. So it's a privilege to join you. And, you know, you said it, I was very ambitious at a young age and I tried not to let people make that a bad word about me. I ran for the House of Representatives in Vermont when I was 22 and won a seat, served 8 years in the House. Went and got my
country, right? Youngest in the country, correct?
At the time, I was the youngest in the country. Yeah, I mean, I love to pass that title on. You know, we need young people to run. And in states like smaller states like New England, it's a little easier financially. You don't have to raise, you know, several zeros worth of finances to run. Then I went and got my master's degree and I came back and ran for the Senate. As you mentioned, I was in a very competitive three-way congressional race, the first three women in competition for Vermont's lone congressional seat. And actually, you know, it was a bit of a healthcare decision and a personal decision to leave the race and endorse Congresswoman Becca Ballant, who went on to win the race, obviously. But I had a miscarriage during the campaign, and I only felt comfortable talking about it much later. But it made me realize, you know, I can't have it all at once. I might want to have it all, but, you know, trying to balance wanting to be a parent, it really just hit me. And so I dropped out of that race and was very well received for that decision, especially in progressive circles, because both of us were ultimately otherwise going to split the progressive ticket. I went back to the state Senate. I now chair Senate Economic Development, Housing, and General Affairs. I am literally the first woman to chair the Economic Development Committee, let alone a woman of color, let alone a woman who's been pregnant twice in the same biennium.
She's talking pregnant about. Now.
Yes, she's pregnant now. She's 21 weeks pregnant now with my second, you know, fighting for childcare and paid family leave and housing. And so, you know, it's really helped me drive home the power of having different voices at the head of the table, but also, you know, engaging in the process and setting the agenda and doing it at the state and local level. People don't realize how much power you have, and you don't have to feel helpless about Washington all the time, which I know many of us do.
Yeah, fabulously. I mean, it's especially right now, it seems there's so much dysfunction in DC, you know, that it's very difficult to think, how can I impact that? When in fact, I'm quite sure that you're the kind of legislator who constituents can still speak with and still work with and still get some answers from.
That's right. You know, I'm a little less responsive than I used to be. Raising a little human and growing a little human at the same time makes you really tired. but my constituents still count on me to give hopefully really honest reflections on what it's like and what we do, both so that they see that we're human, but also hopefully that they see they can do it too one day, you know.
Yeah, speak to that for me, Keisha, because I know that it's something I struggled with years ago too, in pursuing any kind of activity, either politically or in my career, is that you get these sidelong glances sometimes from folks about, you know, how can you, aren't you shortchanging your children? Aren't you shortchanging your career? And the answer was no. Was I burning the candle at both ends sometimes? Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So how do you encourage other women to feel confident, to feel that ambition is okay? It's not a dirty word. It's okay for you to want all of those things, to be a mom, to be a wife, to be active in your community, and to impact change. How do you encourage other women?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think women and people of color and the combination of the two, whatever it is, we're kind of discouraged from taking risks. You know, that that will reflect poorly on you or your character, your family. But when you go out and do it, people will hold you. You know, people really do love to see that. And that's sort of how I've tried to build my my career, and why I love to do what I love to do most of all is because women will come up to me and say, you know, I was scared to run for the school board, and now I'm running for the legislature because, you know, you ran for statewide office at such a young age. And, you know, I think all of that shows people that you don't have to have a certain pedigree to run, and that the diversity of voices is what matters, the diversity of life experiences. So, you know, just sort of showing people that all it takes is hard work, and no, you won't have balance, but, you know, if you communicate in a humane way to your constituents, at least in a place like Vermont, they really respect that. And, you know, mostly what I get is gratitude, just, you know, thanks for being willing to do it while being a parent. And I'm often hearing from especially other moms, you're making it feel possible and, you know, attainable to do more, but, you know, still get the private time I need with my family. So it's never a full balance, but it's following in Governor Madeline Kunin's footsteps, our first and only female governor, you know, that it's worth trying because no one is ever asking men how they're balancing it all.
Right, right. I mean, I just recently on the podcast interviewed Jenna Griswold, our Secretary of State here in Colorado.
Yes.
I think she'd make a marvelous. Colorado does not have a woman, has not had a woman governor yet.
That's right.
Which to me seems incomprehensible because Colorado seems so forward thinking and so forth. However, little Vermont has often been at the forefront of a lot of really important change. And your district, if I'm not wrong, the university is in your district, correct? How does that play into your work in the legislature and in the culture in your district? I know there's been stresses. Certainly students right now are really advocating for change where it comes to the Gaza and Israel situation. Many of us are advocating for some sensible change.
Absolutely.
But talk to me about the University of Vermont and what's happening there.
Yeah, well, I ran as a senior at the University of Vermont, and I was student body president, but I also would come out of, you know, some kind of tent takeover of the campus green for livable wages or for, you know, peace in Darfur. You know, we had our causes of the day as well and things that shaped who I am and what I advocate for now. And, you know, it feels to me like a reminder of when I was, you know, having my formative high school and college years during the Bush presidency and the Iraq War and, you know, environmental degradation and the recession. You know, young people, again, are living through a set of crises that they're really using to try and meet the moment and find their own voice, especially coming out of the isolation of the pandemic. You know, I'm Hindu and Jewish, so not a lot of people know intimately what those redrawn borders do to a family and a people. I just went back to Lahore, Pakistan for the first time in anyone my family has been in 75 years since my family left when it was no longer India. And the people, they actually remember my great-great-grandfather, who was the chief engineer and architect of Lahore. They remember him extremely fondly. And if you ask my family, they left very embittered and thought his legacy was gone. But nothing could be further from the truth. And like, I could have lived a life very embittered and dehumanizing or detaching myself from Muslim communities the same way that unfortunately my father did before he passed. On the other side, you know, were Ukrainian Jews, a country that didn't exist at the time that my family left. But, you know, compassion and the striving for peace and justice really does cross religions and cultures and communities. And I think people are seeing right and wrong for what they are. I actually called for a ceasefire, you know, in October, you know, when things were just looking like they were headed down a very violent and escalating path, you know, I already felt that it was important as someone who spent time in Israel and in the Palestinian territories to call for humanity and for peace and a ceasefire. And then it was only just a couple weeks later, folks probably remember, three young Palestinian men were shot just a few feet from the house I spent my college years in. And one who's my neighbor's nephew was paralyzed and is now paralyzed permanently. So UVM students have a real history, like a Berkeley or, you know, any of the schools that have cultivated free speech and, you know, thinking about how young people engage in conflict. You know, UVM has always had this tradition, but it really hit home with that dehumanizing experience of, you know, people wearing the kafaya and just, you know, expressing themselves as Muslim right near campus. It made students afraid. And now I think they're expressing, you know, that existential fear. But also you can look around these college campuses that are having sit-ins and teach-ins and protests, and they're learning about anti-Semitism and anti-Islamic rhetoric. They're learning together about, you know, shared history, different histories, how the borders were drawn in 1948 and what a poor job the British and the French did of that in the Middle East and everywhere else. Yeah. You know, like, how did we get here? So that's always a valuable thing. Good always comes of that. I know that people are picking up on violent or anti-Semitic rhetoric. And, you know, of course I condemn that. Of course I condemn the October 7th terrorist attack by Hamas. You know, what you have are a very captive people in Palestine, many of whom had absolutely nothing to do with the rise of Hamas or the attack, who now are losing their lives disproportionately and including a lot of children. So, you know, anytime you have essentially children killing children in these wars, you know, we need to remember what it looks like to be on the right side of history. And our young people often remind us of that.
Oh, true. And I'm glad you referenced back to when you were in college, because if we take it back a few years, when I was that age, you know, I my husband and I were just talking today, watching some of the reports, that it looks like the Vietnam era. And thank God for our young people who stand up with that sense of justice and humanity. Mm-hmm. To say, mm-hmm. and like you, I don't want there to be violence, but I don't want there to be violence on either side. I don't want universities to arm themselves against students who are peacefully protesting. And I don't want students to blow up buildings and do things that happen. But at the same time, I think our young people often provide us with that moral compass that we lose as we age, whether it's the pressures of earning a living or whatever it may be, that tends to fade a little bit for some of us. And we're not able to see that North Star of what's fair for everybody on the planet. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, they remind us that it's just surreal that we go on going to the grocery store and, you know, watching television and living our lives amidst such carnage and misery and, you know, children being bombed. It's hard for them to experience that dissonance, and it should be. And it reminds us that, you know, we can't simply ignore the realities of others.
One of the best facts I read about you, because I went on and read more about you today, and one of the facts I read about you is leading students in the fifth grade, when you were in the fifth grade, apparently. And then I thought, you know, I remember walking out of a presentation when I was in about the seventh grade, because they were showing a video. Now, this was film strip time. They were showing a strip of Black people being hosed down in the streets of the southern part of the United States. Could not, as a child, a young, very young teenager, I couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand why. What and why were all these adults not only okay with it, but doing it? It just didn't, it didn't add up for me. And, you know, I think maybe that was good in a way. You know, I don't, when I look back at it, I think, oh, a lot of the stuff we saw at that time was pretty jarring, but so is a lot of the stuff today. A friend of mine is an Afghani woman who's now a United States citizen, but she has been talking pretty openly with me about Hamas's failings and the things that are going on, you know, that money is sent from families trying to help their relatives in Palestine and never gets to those relatives. Takes everything, you know, and so it's just such a mess. But you're right, if you put yourself in the shoes of those people on the ground there, what would you do? It would be the weakest who can't. How would you walk as a mother with a baby, with a child and a baby on the way? How would you walk 500 miles or whatever with no visible means of support? And if we can humanize that a little bit, it makes me wish Jimmy Carter was a lot younger.
God bless him.
Negotiate something, you know, something that would look a little more like peace. So thank you for addressing that. And I'm glad you are the woman who represents in the Senate that part of Burlington and Vermont.
Thank you.
I also wanted to ask you a little bit about, obviously, what you're thinking for the future of the country. You know, when we look at this division, you know, that appears to be in place, you know, I will openly admit, I for sure don't want another Donald Trump presidency. That's just reality for me. But what really hurts is all of the really nasty in society that's going on right now around and what's your take on what's going on in the country and how can we all kind of help resolve this in a better way?
Yeah, I mean it's extremely challenging when we are living in different realities, getting different information, you know, sort of not looking to the same places for answers or trusting the same facts or, you know, you name it. With, I think, campaign financing the way it is, with redistricting the way it is and districts getting more and more polarized, with efforts to disenfranchise voters, and then layering on top of that, you know, a social and news media system that really drives a wedge between us rather than brings us together or tries to bring us into the same sense of reality, the same plane in the universe. You know, you have a recipe for the decay of democracy, unfortunately. So, you know, I don't know that I'm incredibly hopeful in the near term. Always young people, you know, make me feel courageous and hopeful because they're sophisticated. They're trying to reach each other in new ways. But, you know, if we are living in a system that pulls people into algorithms, you know, that just takes them into a really dark place, whether it's political or it's, you know, young teens thinking they need the best skincare routine or, you know, whatever the case is, anxiety and fear keeps people glued to their smartphones and social media. So, you know, we do need technology to be more of our partner than our master in terms of sort of changing the dynamics between us.
Good point. How do we do that, Keisha? How do we do that?
That's a good question. You know, we're thinking a lot about it in the legislature right now. We just passed something called the Kids Code. And it's trying to at least get our social media platform regulation to be somewhat like the regulations in the European Union and the UK. Are things perfect over there? Definitely not. But, you know, adults can't direct message children that they don't know. The algorithms can't pull people, you know, down into these rabbit holes. They don't have infinite scroll, which in our lifetimes, we believe, you know, this is like a bottomless, all-you-can-eat buffet of random information that keeps you on your phone for hours a day. So do we just need it for kids? No, but if we start to get kids into a healthier relationship with their phones and their devices, You know, we change our data privacy settings and we have the freedom to really do that. We start to break this information lock that everybody's stuck in. And that frankly, I try to follow back to our last conversation, you know, people who are on the ground in Israel and in the Palestinian territories, I try to follow people who have very different viewpoints on this. And you can see how if you were just following the information of one side or the other, you'd become very inflamed. You know, you'd hear a perspective that was angering and was one-sided. And it's really hard to teach balance or to teach people to seek out all those different perspectives. It's also really hard to find them. So, you know, I think it's still going to be one young person at a time, one podcast at a time. There's so much information out there, and it's an AI, for example, you know, artificial intelligence is going to help us do things, but it's also going to accelerate, you know, change that we're not prepared for that could take us into really dark places. So, you know, I think it's, I always come back to, you know, education, and we in all of our states are having education policy debates, you know.
Have you had much book banning? Have you had much book banning in Vermont? I would think not, but.
No, I mean, they try some test sites. You know, we have some purple bellwether areas that they try to, you know, pick a book and get Fox News to call in, you know, have everyone call in. But we did pass a bill to prohibit any type of book banning in our schools this year. Vermont is very, you know, how do we make sure we're not victim to all of this while we can? And we're taking a vote probably tomorrow on an education secretary put forth by our Republican governor. Now, we often can find common ground with our Republican governor as a very Democratic legislature. But in this case, you know, he's put someone forward who comes out of a charter school background and out of Florida. And I don't want to discriminate against anybody from Florida, but it's just really set off people in Vermont. You know, yeah, it's real, like people have a visceral reaction to, I don't want anything like what I see in Florida to happen here in Vermont. So it's very questionable what will happen with her confirmation.
Yeah, we have counties just barely south of the Denver metro area. Denver metro is pretty blue, but just south of the Denver metro where Lauren Boebert has moved to, oh my word. Anyway, my goodness, that they're having trouble retaining and getting teachers because of some of the book banning and some of the craziness. And I thought, I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime, that in the United States of America, we'd be talking about book banning. What?
No, it's pretty dystopic.
It doesn't make sense. The other thing I want to make sure you and I talk about, because it just resonates with me about you, is I understand you did a lot of work with domestic violence and with women's reproductive rights. And this was one of the things that hit me so hard. I never even realized how hard it would hit me when Roe v. Wade was overturned. It was like the worst gut punch, because so many women in my generation fought so hard to achieve reproductive rights for women. And now I feel like the argument, I so want to get it out of this argument about anti or pro-abortion, because that's not what it's about for me. What it's about for me is autonomy over my body.
Yeah.
And I have the same freedom over my body that anyone should have over their body. And right. I just, how much are you able to stay engaged with that issue? And how can we best, how do you feel as a legislator in states, which where a lot of the action is going to take place on the issue, how do you feel like we can all make sure that we get women to a point where we do have the same freedom over our bodies?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as you said, it's the hard part is just emotionally staying with the issue when the gut punches keep coming. I mean, to be debating EMTALA and the very idea of, you know, is someone's life worth saving? We're in a really scary place. And I hope what it does is remind people that there is no bottom for these folks who want to dismantle women's rights and women's access to healthcare. They also want to dismantle the access of the LGBT community to healthcare. And eventually, they want to dismantle the healthcare system itself. You know, the you take education, for example, and critical race theory was just a way to build mistrust against teachers and librarians, to vote down school budgets. So, you know, as much as I hate to believe that this isn't the end, they're getting us to question the very foundations of access to healthcare and our own rights over our own body. And so we need to fight on all these fronts. There's no fight that's not worth having, but it's looking at that big picture of how much they're chipping away step by step at, you know, our own belief in taking care of each other and supporting each other through a pandemic or, you know, through the very obvious unknowns to women of, you know, your reproductive journey. It's incredibly frightening and horrifying. And I think challenging about being in a state like Vermont is we just do everything we can in our borders to fortify things. You know, we now have a constitutional right to an abortion enshrined in our state constitution. Just last week, we joined the House in a strong vote to end prior authorization in private health insurance decisions and hopefully lead the nation on that front. So we just keep trying to strengthen healthcare and reproductive freedoms at the same time, and remind people that, you know, everyone should have the choice in terms of end of life care, in terms of, you know, reproductive care. They should have child care, you know, so it's an economic choice they can make as well. You know, Republicans have, unfortunately, especially on the national scene, just become hell-bent on breaking the foundations of what we believe government should provide us. And so I wish it was just about a war on women, but it's really a war on children and a war on society as we know it.
And under the guise of being just the opposite. You know, that's what I always feel like, that somebody's messing with my brain.
I know.
But, you know, I think you and I probably agree on this. You know, I always think that most Americans that I know value pretty much the same stuff. They really do. We want to have safety for our families. We want to be able to provide a home and an education and food and just a decent life. Most of us aren't out after great wealth or, you know, power or those kinds of things. And I think we've lost that sense of we all are kind of, we have shades of it and how we get there. But I just really think somehow and I think you're right, it's the disinformation that's doing it. You know, my grown children have educated me a lot when I tell them, did you see that on the news last night? They'll say, Mom, no one watches that.
Right, right.
No one watches television news for half an hour anymore. My husband and I still do. You know, they get their news in snippets, you know, that comes on social media and comes, and they're very well educated. You know, some of them have gone to the University of Chicago, and I've got two teachers, and we've got all are constantly telling me, you're not getting the same information that the younger generation is getting in the same way you're getting. So I think that for me has been very good for me to be aware that I may be operating in an old world, in an older world, you know, and that maybe I need to think about what you're ingesting and what thank God you're listening to different sides. And I would hope that you do, you know, and we are going to agree with Republicans sometimes. I do on some things. My dad was very Republican until the election in 1992. I called him up after I had gone to vote, and the vote was going to be between the first George Bush and Bill Clinton. And I said to my father, I said, Dad, please, please, please. I said, I know how you think you want to vote, but this election isn't about you anymore. And it's not even about me anymore. It's about your grandchildren, and it's about their children. And, you know, my dad called me later in the day, and he said, it's all yours, kid. And I think what he was trying to say without saying it is, for the first time in his life, he voted for his grandkids. And I think those kinds of conversations are going to have to happen between the generations. to say, you know, to educate one another that things aren't as they were in Vietnam's era. They aren't as they were in the apartheid era against South Africa. They aren't as they were in your era on the college campus. You're right. You pointed out to me, and I hadn't thought that today. These young people on the college campuses, they're coming out of a horrible period of this pandemic that none of us lived through before. None of us knew how, none of us know how this is all going to play out as we go forward.
Yeah.
So in your heart and in your mind, where do you see yourself taking your career as you go forward, whether it's politics? Well, you know, I know you're going to have wonderful kiddos and you're going to have, you know, that's going to be great. But what would you like to see for you? If you could picture 5, 10 years from now, what would you like to see?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is hard to see past having two under two in the very near term, like 2 days of September. And, you know, and as we discussed, child number two is nothing like child number one. You don't know, you have to learn everything all over again with a new human that has very different wants and needs. And that has been just extremely grounding to watch my one-year-old, you know, she just turned one, sort of look at the world with curiosity and wonder. Thank you. And just, you know, there's no reason for her to not feel loving and loved and
hopeful.
Yeah. And I just, you know, so it is really important to me to just keep giving her as much of that as I can until it's the turn of other adults to do that for her and then her friends. And, you know, so I'm really enjoying the process of watching this little person grow up. And I think what's been really nice about being back in the Senate after kind of getting a taste of Washington, you know, a brush with it in a congressional race, is I really do want to be where I feel useful, you know, and where I know I can make a difference. And some people are making a difference in Washington because they're able to sort of cut through all of that noise and nonsense and, you know, maybe, yeah, either they're it's the Bernies of the world, you know, we have a great delegation.
Yeah, you're very lucky.
Yes. But even, you know, even worse saying, gosh, I, you know, we hope Bernie runs again this year. I think that's universal for the most part in the state. And we hope as chairman of, you know, the Health and Labor Committee, he really is able to advance Medicare for all,
absolutely.
You know, just put everything left that he's got into it, because it is still absolutely just a mostly quiet crisis. You know, we just don't know what to do. And so it's eating up more and more of our family budgets and our school budgets and our hospital budgets and state budgets. And, you know, for less quality, and for
maybe Vermont will take a run at it again. You never know.
We could. I mean, just the burnout in the healthcare field is immense, especially after the pandemic. So, you know, not to get on a healthcare soapbox because I know who I'm talking
to. That's
okay.
I like that soapbox.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I'm reminded that now that I have not just a seat at the table, but a seat at the head of the table of our economic policy, you know, that is not something to take lightly and sort of give up for the next big thing that comes along. You know, our state Senate is really leading some conversations that are affecting national politics. You know, I've been able to do a lot on ending single family zoning and creating more access to housing. And it really means a lot after I passed the bill from the hospital when I was giving birth to Mira to go to a New England housing conference and have people say, we all like copied your bill and started with what we could. And you're like a housing hero. You know, I get to just be the biggest nerd and bring my kids to the state house and, you know, enjoy life. So it's a weird time. We don't know who you know, how the election will go. I certainly know you and I hope it goes a certain way. But, you know, it really is a time when it's more important to be the best citizen you can be and the best neighbor you can be than it is to sort of be president, which has lost its sheen a little bit after the last one. You know, so I think it's just really being on the ground to remind people they can all make a difference. You know, what we do in local and state politics really matters. And, you know, what we do in our home lives and in our school districts has a huge impact. You know, just going back to what you were saying about, you know, sort of young people and where they get information. I mean, you know, our system of our democratic system, you know, the information we get says we're more divided than we are. How we have to ultimately vote red or blue, you know, a polarized district that's been gerrymandered to no end, it makes us feel more divided than we really actually are. And hence, when states have these big referendums on abortion or, you know, education or whatever it is, they usually end up revealing that 60 to 80% of the population is in general agreement and just wants safety and well-being and, you know, sanity. And so really our job, I think, is very much on that local and state level to remind people, you know, forget what Washington's telling you. You actually do all share the same common ground. We are all, you know, similar in our values and just what we want for our families. And so I'm just really enjoying sort of holding my little corner of the world together the best I can.
Well, you are an inspiration to me, so much so. I mean, I just, you know, I look and I think, you know, how dare me ever think that my 15 now grandchildren would not impact, though I know it's unbelievable. I know there's a child bride.
I aspire. That's incredible.
No, they're wonderful people. And when I talk to them, they're very diverse politically, if you ask them. And yet they're all good community members. And that's what really matters. That's what matters to me. That's what I want the next generation to be. And Keisha, you stand as a light to so many young women and young people, not only in Vermont, but around the country. And I hope that you'll join us again in the future. I hope that what this life holds for you is not only just great blessings, but also increased leadership in Vermont. I think you could be very impactful, and I know you will be. And thank you for being with us today. And give a hug to that little girl. She is so adorable. Oh my gosh, she's like your mini-me already.
Yes, she is. She's really a little politician. She's always reaching her hand out to greet people and everything. But I will, Donna, and thank you. You know, all we can do is connect with each other and tell stories. And you've done that so beautifully for so long. So it's always a privilege to be in your orbit.
Thank you so much. And have a great evening. Thanks for joining me. I get to go watch the Denver Nuggets beat the LA Lakers.
Okay. Well, I'm a native of Los Angeles, but I will root for your team tonight.
Okay, good. Thanks, Keisha. Bye. All right.
Bye. Thanks, Donna.
Thank you for listening to Positively Progressive, brought to you by Progressive Democrats of America. To find out more about PDA and Positively Progressive, go to pdamerica.org. And please tell your friends, family, and coworkers about Positively Progressive. I'm Alan Niskey on behalf of Donna Smith. Until next time, stay positively progressive.